From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Colin Murphy has written a book about the Inquisition. He points out the story is a record of lives disrupted, ideas called into question, voices silenced. But Murphy doesn't see the Inquisition as a remnant of history. He says it helps us understand the world that exists today. Consider what an Inquisition is. It's a set of disciplinary procedures codified into law that target specific groups. That could describe any number of modern methods used by governments in the 21st century. Today in the program, Murphy will join us to talk about the Inquisition of history and the form that persists. As he puts it, it's blind bureaucratic inertia, harnessed to earthly and spiritual power and moral certainty. The book is called God's Jury. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Colin Murphy is our guest. He's written a book that explores the complex and little understood history of the Inquisition. Murphy is not just looking at this story as a moment of the past. He's interested in how it helps explain the world that exists today. So the book is not about the debate over the historical Inquisition as much as it is about the behavior that brings Inquisitions into existence, what he calls this inquisitorial impulse. Murphy says the Inquisition was kind of a template for modern governments who try and keep citizens in line. It provided the actual techniques and tools that are still used today: surveillance, censorship, torture. The book is called God's Jury, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. Colin Murphy is editor-at-large at Vanity Fair magazine, the former managing editor of the Atlantic Monthly. He's also the author of the books Are We Rome and The World According to Eve. And he's joining us today from a studio in Boston. And Colin Murphy, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. Great to be with you, Doug.
I wanted to begin with the journey that you took to the Vatican, to the headquarters of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, because it's sort of where you start in the book, and in some ways that's where you end up in the book as well. Talk about why you went there and what were you at least initially looking for, trying to find out?
Over the course of 30, 35 years as a writer, much of what I've done has been focused on religion. And during that period of time, I've gotten to know many theologians, Catholic theologians, who one way or another ran into trouble with the Vatican. And I think most listeners hear reports of this sort of thing happening. Someone loses a job or loses the right to teach as a Catholic theologian or is silent somehow. But there are sometimes repercussions for theologians who cross some sort of line, and that got me interested in the Inquisition as a subject, as something that might be living inside the church. But one of these theologians mentioned to me that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith actually had its headquarters in the building that was built for one of the Inquisitions in the 16th century. And this to me was kind of an astonishing fact. Since the Congregation is the Vatican's theological watchdog, which presents a kind of PR problem right there, I would have thought they might have found another location for it than than the Inquisition building. So that pretty much put this place, this old palazzo, on the map for me. And I was determined to get inside, which turned out not to be very hard because it has been open to scholars and others for about a decade now. So I went there and got inside and was helped by many people, scholars and the director there. As well.
We'll move past this, but I do want to ask about the time you spent there, because it's really interesting. You talk about going into these archives and you describe the filing system there, which has its own kind of logic, but there's kind of some interesting stories in there that you tell. One is stumbling upon, as you do, the Papal Index, this index of forbidden books. Say something about that, if you will.
Probably a lot of folks have seen that that TV show called Antiques Roadshow. And so I was in the archives one day. I was being taken around by a scholar friend, and there was this piece of furniture. It was kind of a wooden rack, and it had two wooden boxes on it. And they look like, you know, let's say, you know, coffins for a snake. And they were resting one on top of the other, and one of them said A to K, and the other one said L to Z. And so I flipped open the tops of the boxes, and I saw they were filled with index cards. And you know, I took some of them out just to see what they said, and it was names like, you know, Spinoza or Jean-Paul Sartre. But I didn't really know what the boxes were. And I turned to the director of the archives and just said, you know, what's this? And he said, well, that's the Index of Forbidden Books. And to me, it was astonishing. It was like, you know, it was like when Toto pulls the curtain back on the Great Oz, the idea that that the Index of Forbidden Books, which is this, you know, this iconic bugbear for Catholics, wasn't abolished until 1966, that it had a physical existence inside something as quaint and in a way as beautiful as these two boxes.
As you point out in the book, you're an American, you're a Catholic. So I'm wondering how that perspective affected the way you approached the book. Because you say that, you know, those who write about the Inquisition usually have, you know, deep concerns, if not an actual agenda, and you kind of cop to this in the book.
Yes, I think it's something that has to be copped to at the outset.
Yeah.
Everyone, I think, who has written about the Inquisition, really from, you know, for 500 years, has had something on their mind other than simply, you know, writing history. And during the Reformation, when one of the Inquisitions was very much at its height, trying to, you know, track down Protestantism and keep Protestants at bay. Mm. There was a lot of polemical literature. The English, in particular, were awfully good at this, and the Catholics were just as good throwing it back. Now, I don't really have a polemical stake of that sort in this fight, but you know, I am a Catholic and I am an American, and I do cherish the higher values of both the church and the country. At the same time, one can't be blind to flaws and you know, deep and tragic errors that both have committed. So I wanted to mention that at the outset of the book, so people would know that these issues were actually shaping my perspective.
So you go to the archive with kind of one idea in mind. But it seems like the idea, of course, evolves into something else. When did you start to see this broader theme linking, you know, the historical Inquisition with the modern world?
Two things, really. But you're absolutely right. I started this project a long time ago. It was in the 1990s when the idea first came to me. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, it was the stories of theologians who I had encountered that first got me interested in looking at the Inquisition, the extent to which, you know, inquisitorial practices, you know, might survive into the present day. That was the basic idea, and but a couple things happened. One was that as I began to get to know scholars much better. At this point, there are probably, you know, 30 or 40, you know, really world-class scholars who are looking at the Inquisition. It's been a kind of a golden age of Inquisition scholarship. I began to notice that some of the things that they were talking about really transcended the Inquisition itself. They were looking at what made the Inquisition possible. You know, what were the tools that it used? Mm-hmm. And as they began to approach that kind of territory, you could see that those tools were not things that were specifically medieval. In fact, they look kind of modern. So that was one thought. And the second was the aftermath of 9/11.
Right.
And obviously 9/11 was a horrific event to which this country and other countries needed to respond strongly in many ways. But some of the responses, at least to my mind, went in directions that also called the Inquisition to mind. And, you know, I think specifically of something like surveillance, mm-hmm. which was certainly something that the Inquisition did, and also something like torture, which I think everybody knows is something that the Inquisition did and did without apology. It thought torture was a legitimate part of the process of ferreting out truth.
You talk about in the book the kind of the you comment on the infamy of the Inquisition, but you also talk about how, for all of its fame, the real Inquisition, or Inquisitions, as you point out and as we'll talk about, isn't really very well known or understood. It seems like there's this kind of caricature we have of the Inquisition.
Well, there's one thing that everybody knows about the Inquisition, and that is Monty Python.
Right.
And no one expects the Spanish Inquisition. And I guess probably some people also know the great song and dance number in that Mel Brooks created for History of the World. It's a funny thing about the Inquisition. It's a word, everybody knows the word.
Yeah.
And you throw it around casually, and you know something happens in the news, and some commentator will say, "Oh, it's another Inquisition." But then, when you begin to scratch the surface a little bit and ask people, "Well, you know, what do you actually know?" People don't know really very much. I think, in some ways, in the English speaking world, the whole subject has been kind of overwhelmed. You know, partly because of the, and this is just going back in history a little bit, but the long contest between England and Spain, which was kind of the Cold War of its time, and there was so much literature written, you know, people throwing polemical tracts at one another, and so since we're in this country the inheritors of the English tradition, at least in terms of history, we have a certain view of it. Which is partly accurate, but also partly not accurate.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that you say that the Inquisition, of course, could be brutal, really brutal in its methods. But in some ways, maybe not as much as we thought. I mean, you say that there were rules that they applied. They had standards. It gave some of the accused at certain points in these Inquisitions over time certain rights. And it seems like this is really important, that the relationship between evidence, the law, you know, legal procedure, those sorts of things, was really interconnected into all of this, which makes it a much more complex story.
Well, let me make two points with respect to that. One of them, when you talk about brutality, one of the things that everyone associates with the Inquisition is burning at the stake.
Yeah.
And this was, of course, a brutal way to die. And sometimes it was more brutal than it even had to be. For instance, if the inquisitors wanted someone to suffer particularly badly, they might use green wood, which would burn much more slowly, and death would take a much longer time. On the other hand, if they were trying to be, what they would regard as merciful, they might strangle the person first, or they might attach a little sack of gunpowder to their to their waist, so that it would explode at a certain time and bring the end much more quickly. But to move on to your other point about evidence and rules, the Inquisition laid down a lot of rules. It was a legal regime. It's an important point to remember. This was not something that was being done by rogue elements. It was something that was actually institutionalized. It had the sanction of authorities. And the authorities knew that this was really tough medicine. And they knew that it got you into very problematic moral ground. So they tried to put rules in place. The problem, and I think we've seen this problem in our own time, is that it's very easy to begin to push the rules. And, once you've allowed a certain thing to occur, then allowing that thing to occur in a way that's a little bit worse or a little bit harsher, it's not that hard to justify. And you see this in all kinds of ways, with torture in particular.
Yeah. I mean, you point out there's always been intolerance and always been hate throughout human history. There's always been, some kind of persecution and violence. But what makes the Inquisition different, and this seems like this kind of one of the central themes in the book, is that the Inquisition, as you said, gave it an institutional sort of structure, which seems that I guess that's the innovation of the Inquisition, is, as you put it in the book, managing and attending to this persecution.
That's exactly right. You know, you read the books of antiquity, you read the Bible, and you're not going to have to read for very long before you encounter acts of violence by one group or another, or religious intolerance, or ethnic intolerance, and hatred of all kinds. This is just woven through human history. But the Inquisition is something different. You know, it is the answer to the question. So let's say you want to persecute a particular group, you hate a particular group, you want to impose your own point of view somehow. Okay, well, you know, it's one thing to have an explosion of violence, you know, against the people you regard as your foes. Mm. You know, that happens. But how do you make something like that a procedure that goes on for generation after generation and for centuries? And we're talking about something that, you know, the Roman Inquisition, which was run by the Vatican, wasn't formally abolished until 1908, which is pretty recent. So how do you accomplish that? And that's really the subject that I try to focus on, because they had all kinds of ways, you know, manuals, you know, interrogation manuals, for instance, which was something I find particularly fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I want to break some of these down because they are particularly interesting, and not just, again, which is gets to the bigger point of your book, not just as an historical moment, but how then those procedures, those manuals, even those particular techniques relate to what's going on in the modern world. The other part of this that's really interesting, and it seems like an important factor too, Colin Murphy, is in the making of an Inquisition, this conviction that you're absolutely right, this idea of moral certainty, seems like one of the really critical components.
Yes, it is. There are two essential components to an Inquisition. One of them is some of these tools that I mentioned and that we'll discuss in a minute that allow you to institutionalize what you're trying to do, you know, bureaucracy and record keeping and so on. But put that aside. The other thing that is essential is this idea of moral certainty, the idea that you possess a truth that you are so sure of, and also that you believe everyone else ought to subscribe to for their own good, or for the good of, you know, the future of humanity, that you have the right to impose this on everyone, you know, no matter what the consequences, and no matter what other values that you decide you're going to sweep aside in order to pursue. You know, that notion is one that is not merely medieval. It's one that we see today. It's the one that animates terrorism, for instance. And it's the one that animated the Soviet regime in Russia. And it crops up all the time because it's a very human impulse. And it is the engine also of the Inquisition. You know, the people who were running the Inquisition, by their own lights, they were sincere. They actually believed what they were trying to impose, and they believed that it was good for the people that they were imposing it on, even if it killed them.
Yeah, they were sending these souls to heaven.
Yeah, exactly. That's why, you know, there's an episode involving a cardinal, great cardinal and theologian named Robert Bellarmine, who is in fact a saint, and you can even see his body in Rome. It's under glass in a church in the middle of the city. And he was involved in the case of a man named Giordano Bruno, who was a kind of cranky cosmologist and who got into trouble with the papacy and with the Inquisition. And he was eventually sentenced to be burned at the stake, and he was. You can still see his statue in the Campo dei Fiori in Rome. And Bellarmine was one of the people involved in his interrogation. And ever after, Bellarmine was kind of intellectually sickened by what had happened, that he had not been able to persuade Bruno to recant before being burned at the stake. It wasn't the burning at the stake so that bothered him so much. It was the failure in Bellarmine's mind, you know, to save his soul.
You write about some of the inquisitors actually climbing onto this these piles of wood as they're burning or before they're burning in that last-ditch attempt to save their soul.
That's right, and you know, sometimes it worked. Recanting at that point was not going to save their physical person.
Yeah.
But that was something that happened frequently.
In a world of moral certainty, you say the unthinkable becomes permissible. Cullen Murphy is with us. His book is called God's Jury, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Cullen Murphy is our guest. We're talking about his book about the Inquisition. Murphy is interested in how the Inquisition helps explain the world that exists today. It's called God's Jury, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. Well, there were sort of three Inquisitions, not one like a lot of us sort of think of. And the first one was sort of set out to do away with heretics, the principal heretics at that time. I guess this was the 13th century. This was the Cathars, the Catharism. These were dualists, and this is how the Inquisition first started. The Church set out to detect those who weren't loyal and destroy Catharism, I guess.
And they did a pretty good job. A few days ago, I was speaking with a group and was making the point that there aren't many Cathars around any longer. In fact, haven't been for a few hundred years. And an old man afterwards came up to me and he said very quietly, sort of leaning over and whispering, said, "I am a Cathar."
Wow.
So we know at least one got away. But the issue here was that as the Church was becoming more centralized, the Pope was becoming more powerful, and as an institution, it was becoming more modern.
Yeah.
It began defining things much more carefully. What does it mean to be a Catholic? What do you need to believe? What takes you across the line, and so on. And as it did so, an awful lot of people found themselves on the other side of the line. And then there were people like the Cathars who were just way outside the line. They, as you say, they were dualists. They hated the physical world. They thought the Church was completely corrupt, and it was partly corrupt. And they were also sometimes in league with local feudal lords. It was a big problem from the point of view of the Church, and they tried many ways of dealing with this, but ultimately they came up with the Inquisition, which basically involved sending priests out into the local communities, interrogating people, getting denunciations from neighbors, conducting trials of various kinds, and then meting out punishments. And sometimes it was death. More often it wasn't. It was other kinds of things. And this is known as the medieval Inquisition. And as I said, it was very successful. It dealt with this problem very handily.
You write about how the process for doing this had kind of a long history, grew out of, as you say in the book, developments in ancient Roman law. You talk about how these clerics who are inquisitors now, they arrive in a community, preach a sermon, declare this grace period. Although it's interesting, you point out the grace period tends to create heresy, you talk about. Say something about that process, because you say it's really labor-intensive, it's time-consuming.
Well, let me pause just for a second on this what you've just mentioned, the period of grace, because it's an important factor here. So what would happen is an inquisitor would arrive, often with armed guards.
Yeah.
It wasn't as if people were going to accept all of this lying down.
Right.
And he would preach a sermon and he would say, now you have until, you know, let's just say March 1st to come forward and either confess your sins or tell me something about your neighbors. And if you do that by March 1st, we're going to be really lenient with you. And of course, this creates a real incentive, both to confess something, basically just to get off the hook, or to say something about a neighbor. And it may be a neighbor you've been feuding with for, you know, decades. So as a result, denunciations and confessions tend to pour forth because of this thing called the Edict of Grace. So that's one way in which it kind of creates heresy. Mm. The procedure itself, it does go back a long way. It goes back to ancient Rome. And there are certain things built into it that it's not hard to see why they would cause a real problem if you look at this from modern eyes. One of them is that the people being accused usually don't know what they're being accused of.
Yeah.
And they also don't know who has been doing the accusing. You know, these are things that, as a defendant, you know, I would certainly want to know.
Right.
And there are many times when you you look at transcripts of torture, and the inquisitors were meticulous about writing down almost verbatim what happened when people were being interrogated, and you often hear the person who is being interrogated, crying out in pain, saying, you know, tell me what I'm supposed to say.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm supposed to say, in order to make the interrogation or the torture stop, because they don't know what they've been charged with. And there was one other aspect about the process, which is basically the inquisitor was prosecutor, judge, and jury, all roles, you know, rolled into one.
Seems like each Inquisition had a grand inquisitor. This first Inquisition had Bernard. Is it Guy?
Guy. Yes.
A detail man, you say, wrote everything down. And there's this, in fact, this kind of fascinating accounting that you include in the book of the expenses used in the burning of four heretics in 1323. I mean, they really put everything down.
Down to the cost of the rope to that was used to bind the victim's hands. They were meticulous, the inquisitors, and it's a point that really can't be overemphasized, how important information gathering is.
Yeah, yeah.
When it comes to maintaining a kind of repressive regime, and yeah, this is one of the ways in which the Inquisition is modern. It didn't used to be that that governments knew how to collect information very well, preserve it very well, or then find it.
Hmm.
And you know, there are all kinds of moments when you look back in early medieval history when monarchs are trying to put their hands on a document that they know exists, and they send their secretaries into the archives and they can't find it. But the inquisitors, in many ways, solved that problem. They were very good at information technology, and this man that you mentioned, Bernard Guy, was one of those people. On one occasion went to the British Library to see the book that he compiled. It's kind of a compendium of his entire career, and it's beautifully organized. Every person he ever interrogated, where they came from.
Wow.
It's indexed, very easy to use. It's searchable. It's kind of a search engine, and
yeah.
Other inquisitors did the same thing. And it's key to understanding how you can maintain a regime of this kind.
So we've talked about the tools, some of those. So this is the record-keeping part that was so important. We talked about a system of law. Another one is a process for conducting the interrogations. And you mentioned Guy, who created this kind of manual for interrogation. He wanted, as you say, to create a kind of science of interrogation. Talk about that, if you would. And Nicholas Emmerich is also... Or Emmerich is also an important figure here.
The two of them are probably the best known, and the works that they created were extremely influential and widely copied, and then after the printing press, widely printed. The problem that they faced was really twofold. One of them was just a matter of training.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to have a something like an Inquisition that you want to last for a long period of time, well, you can't just have one generation of inquisitors. You've got to train the next one, and then the next one has to train the one after that. So you have to come up with ways of teaching. And so as a result, there are manuals, and Bernard Guy and Aymeric wrote them. And the second issue is interrogation is not something that is effectively done haphazardly.
Yeah.
You know, we know from our own experience, you know, in the here and now, that the police, in completely legitimate ways, have techniques that they use to interrogate people, you know, to get around, you know, the resistance that people have to talking. They have tricks that they use. And I'm not talking about anything that crosses the line here.
Sure, sure.
And it took a long time for these procedures to develop. Well, the inquisitors were very adept at developing these techniques. And if you read the manual of someone like Bernard Guy or of Nicholas Aymeric, you see them all listed. And it's done in the most kind of amazing way. You see actual sample questions and answers. An inquisitor asks a question, and then underneath that will be written the sly and slippery answer that the heretic will give, mm-hmm. trying to get out of the problem that the inquisitor is posing. And then after that will be the question that the inquisitor asks that strikes to the heart of that answer and exposes the heretic for what he really is. And it goes on and on like that. There are techniques that, the good inquisitor, bad inquisitor, technique. Or there's another one where Nicholas Aymeric is advising, how do you put the fear of God in someone who's sitting in front of you and is, telling you a story and you want to make that person really uncomfortable? And he says, well, a good thing to do is have a big stack of documents in front of you, and even if they're fake. And as the person is talking, you should be flipping through them, and occasionally looking down at something on the page, and then look up at the person you're interrogating and shake your head as if you don't believe a word he says, and the refutation is right there in front of you on the page. This is the kind of thing that's done today.
This is psyops in some ways, isn't it?
It's exactly. In fact, there's at one point I went and I wanted to see if you compared the interrogation techniques. And I'm not talking about torture here, just the interrogation techniques,
sure. Yeah.
Of the inquisitors with those that are used by that are allowed by the Army Field Manual. How much correspondence is there between them? And there's a lot. It's actually hard to find something in one book that isn't in the other book. And it just shows you how skilled and developed the inquisitors actually became very quickly.
Cullen Murphy is with us. His book is called God's Jury: The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Cullen Murphy. We're talking about his book, God's Jury: The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. So the second incarnation of the Inquisition begins in the 15th century. It's instituted by Ferdinand and Isabella. You talk about how it's not easy to describe the society out of which this grew. I mean, this was directed at Jews, the Jews who had converted to Christianity, but who may be kind of rethinking that idea. And I wanted you to talk about that. And the modern parallel here, of course, seems clear enough. And these are the questions that we raise about you know, about a person's loyalty and about what they seem to be doing in secret and whether if they have a position of power, they're trying to undermine, you know, undermine the state. You know, how committed are they to us, I guess?
That's certainly part of it. And also factoring into this is just the suspicion that people harbor towards those who are somehow other than themselves,
right,
different from them, from themselves. And further, in this particular instance, there's an overlay of theology, which is the strain of anti-Semitism that can be found in some Catholic teaching for a very long period of time, going back to antiquity. Spain was a deeply anti-Semitic society for complicated reasons. There had been pogroms of various kinds for a century and more before the Inquisition was formally established, and the Jews who you just mentioned who had converted to Christianity, they usually hadn't done so just out of their own desires.
Right.
They had been forced to do so, or the incentives, let's put it that way, pushed them in that direction. And of course, in some Catholic circles, clerical circles, there was always the suspicion that these people were not sincere and that they were secretly practicing Judaism. And this was intolerable. And so this contributed, you know, mightily to the start, to the founding of the Spanish Inquisition. Other things did too, but once it started, it was ferocious. And in the first 15 years, I think the best estimate is that some 2,000 people were burned at the stake, mostly for Judaizing. And one important fact about the Spanish Inquisition was that it was always under the control of the monarchs.
Right.
This one was not run by the Pope. He gave it permission to start. He had actually great misgivings very quickly when he saw what was happening. The misgivings were irrelevant, and the Spanish Inquisition went on up until the 1830s, and it spread.
Yeah, you know,
it spread around the world as the Spanish Empire spread, and similarly, the Portuguese Inquisition, the same thing happened, which is why you get the Inquisition, in the Philippines and in India and in parts of Africa and throughout Latin America, and even in Santa Fe had an Inquisition, and California had a little bit of an Inquisition, where the last act of the Inquisition in California was to try to forbid the waltz.
Wow. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let's take some phone calls. David is with us in Mona, Utah. David, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I appreciate your program. At any rate, I, in high school, came across an account of an Inquisition in New Mexico, and it got me started digging. And the situation that I have wondered about, because it got me digging and I wound up writing a full thesis on it, was what became of the Jews after, there are accounts where they killed whole towns of Jews, and how they would kill Jewish women who were pregnant to keep them from having a child and things like that. But as they did those things, what became of the Jews? Is that how they were driven into Russia, or were they already in Russia?
Cola Murphy, you don't write a lot about that. Do you want to say something about that, though?
Sure. I'll speak more generally, not about New Mexico, but first of all, one of the most catastrophic events in Jewish history was the expulsion of the Jews from Spain.
Yeah.
And this happens, the year 1492 for Americans generally has a very different connotation of what happened that year. But shortly after Ferdinand and Isabella waved goodbye to Columbus and sent him on his way, they also signed a document called the Edict of Expulsion, which expelled any Jews who would not convert from Spain. And tens of thousands left Spain at that time, and they went to various places. They went to North Africa. Some of them went to, you know, to France. Some went to Portugal until they were expelled from there. And then from those places, they went to, you know, the Ottoman Empire. Some of them followed the imperial flag and went to the New World, or they went to India. You know, it's an extraordinary story. And we know that, that some went up to New Mexico. And you know, to this day, there's an intricate and complicated scholarly argument about whether remnants of some of these Jewish communities still exist in rural places in New Mexico. It's a fascinating story, and have been some great books written about the Jewish diaspora as a result of the expulsion from Spain.
Yeah. David, glad you called. Thanks a lot. Back to the phones. Arthur is with us in Park City. Arthur, welcome. Arthur,
I'm actually in Salt Lake City.
Oh, sorry.
I had a question for him. It's good to be on your show again. I have been told by some Catholic scholars, so one could argue they're partisan, but they were, you know, academics, that not counting the Spanish Inquisition where there were political motives, the other Inquisitions, although they tortured a lot of people, actually killed very few, that it was less than a dozen, perhaps less than half a dozen. And I was wondering if your guest would know about that.
Cone, yes, I can address that. So the people that you've been speaking with are right in one sense, which is that the Spanish Inquisition was the most violent, and more people were killed by the Spanish Inquisition than by any of the others, and I think the Portuguese Inquisition would then come next. The medieval Inquisition, which was the first of them, and then the third of them, the Roman Inquisition, which was started to combat Protestantism, did not put as many people to death as the Spanish or the Portuguese Inquisitions did. All told, though, you're looking at large numbers of people who were killed. You know, certainly tens of thousands of people were put to death by the Inquisition, but primarily the Spanish and the Portuguese.
It's interesting to see how torture comes into the picture, Colin Murphy. It comes along with legal practice. Having a legal system meant that you needed evidence and you needed proof and a confession. Well, that's the ultimate proof. And this is how torture sort of comes into the picture in the Inquisition.
That's right. I remember being really taken aback when this was explained to me by a wonderful scholar named Edward Peters, who has written a book by the name of Torture, in which he lays all this out. But what he was explaining to me one day was, you know, most people probably think of torture as, you know, as a throwback, as something that's very primitive. And he was saying, well, sure, it is in a kind of an emotional and gut way, but the reason it became part of the judicial system was because of something that was very modern, and it was this. You know, it used to be way back when that when you wanted to determine somebody's guilt or innocence, you basically asked God, and this is why you had trial by ordeal. You know, you dunked people in water, or you made them walk on coals and saw what the result was, and this was somehow God speaking and deciding the issue. Well, you know, this is not really a very acceptable form of legal practice,
yeah.
And so as people began to decide, well, you know, maybe we can figure out guilt or innocence on our own, we can take it into human hands. Then this issue of, well, how do you decide what constitutes proof? And a confession is a kind of proof. That's a pretty good kind of proof, but people don't often confess. And so if you're going to urge them to confess, maybe persuade them to confess, what kind of tools do you have to do that? Well, you know, torture is one that comes to mind, and it came to mind to the inquisitors, and the Pope in the middle of the 13th century actually said, yes, torture is a tool that is legitimate to use in order to, you know, to get a confession or confirm a confession, and sometimes, you know, to get the names of other people that we should be talking to.
You write about the different methods of coercion. I mean, you get pretty specific about, because again, as you say, the meticulous records were being kept. You know what was interesting was the moment Colin Murphy, when there are screams quoted in some of these interrogation documents.
You know, we were talking not long ago about record keeping.
Yeah.
Every time there was an interrogation, or every time there was an instance of torture, you would have certain people in the room, and you would have the person who was asking the questions. You would have the person who was doing the torture, who typically would not have been a priest. You would have a doctor, and you would have a secretary. And imagine the secretary being someone like a court stenographer who's just, you know, sitting there impassive, you know, typing away, except not typing in this instance.
Yep.
And noting what is happening, you know, and so it sounds like, you know, you'll read things like, and then another turn of the winch was made, and then the person who was being questioned said, you know, my God, my God, my God, what do you want me to say? Oh, please stop. And then two more turns of the winch were applied. It's this very cold, clinical kind of account of the proceedings. And these kinds of documents survive in very large numbers.
You write about the techniques used by the Spanish inquisitors. There's the garrucha, which is kind of this pulley. There's the rack. Most of us know what that is. But it's the third technique you mentioned that I wanted to talk about, which has become sort of infamous. It involved water. It was called the toca, which means cloth, I guess, and modern audiences would be familiar with it. This is waterboarding, basically.
This is waterboarding, and it is exactly waterboarding. And so during the past, you know, decade or so, I think Americans and others around the world have become much more familiar with waterboarding than they ever were before, because this technique has been used on uncertain detainees that have been in American custody, and some of them have been waterboarded, you know, many, many times. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, was waterboarded 183 times. Mm. But the technique was used routinely by the Spanish Inquisition, and it simulates drowning, although that doesn't quite get the idea across, because if you continue this technique, you don't stop it. The simulation of drowning actually turns into drowning. One of the reasons that has come up in our own times is because of the debate over whether this is torture.
Right.
And you can get into a semantic discussion about this. I know the Bush administration maintained devoutly that it was not torture. The Inquisition matter-of-factly said that it was torture. You know, it was basically on their list of torture techniques. So, you know, one can let the Inquisition and the administration fight that one out. But it was a horrific form of questioning. And, you know, a number of people recently have subjected themselves to waterboarding to describe it, including the late colleague Christopher Hitchens, who wrote a memorable piece about it in Vanity Fair.
I wanted to come back around to moral certainty, because you say this is sort of the indispensable ingredient in an inquisition. And you say that, you know, you would think that there would be less moral certainty today than in the past because, you know, as you say, the power of the church is diminished and certain social movements have kind of fallen by the wayside. But you say as a personal matter, as what an individual actually believes, this certainty is as pervasive as ever.
Well, that certainly is my view. And but let's step back for just one moment. You can look at the issue of moral certainty, you know, just as it pertains to the United States of America, or just as it pertains to, you know, the Western world. But of course, there's an entire planet here that we're living on, and the norms in that planet are not necessarily the norms that we're used to. I think it's not hard to look beyond our borders at other places and quickly come to the realization that moral certainty is alive and well. The people who have been committing terrorist acts in the name of religion, moral certainty is what guides them. And now to shift to the United States, there have been times in our history when we have allowed certain kinds of fears to override other principles. During the Red Scare, for instance, or the internment of the Japanese, there's no church in the United States that exercises the kind of power that the Catholic Church once exercised, in Europe and other places. But when you look at various kinds of debates, including debates that are occurring right now in the political campaigns, you see frequently people who are making moral claims that they believe ought to be universal and ought to, essentially be the rule in the United States, whether it's about, issues of marriage or contraception or the question of, is the United States a Christian nation?
Yeah. Carl Murphy, I'm going to step in there. Sorry, because we're out of time. God's Jury is the name of the book, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.